يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Part two of today's Middle East Analysis. We've been joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, the Bishop's consultant on the Middle East, to talk to us about all the various different things that are going on in the Middle East, North Africa region, of which, of course, there are many. Syria was our focus in part one, and Dr. Hagopian also gave us the regional roundup. Before we go on to Egypt, which is our next major point, Harry, do you want to say a word or two about Yemen and Israel-Palestine? Because I'm conscious we haven't brought them up yet, and there are plenty of bits and bobs going on there.
That's true, actually, James. When I did a quick regional roundup before we spoke about Syria in part one of this podcast, I was trying to be a bit succinct, and I left those two out, which is not right. Yemen clearly is also a cause for concern in terms of the amount of unrest it could introduce into the Arabian Peninsula and into the whole region. But one good thing that came out of Yemen is finally the Yemeni president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, agreed to sign the agreement that was tailored and drafted by the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC, in order for him to abdicate, to cede his powers to his deputy, and his deputy would then ask for the formation of a new government that would lead into new parliamentary and presidential elections. So Yemen is important for many reasons. Yemen is important because it's at the tip of the Arabian Peninsula, and it actually could be a source of chaos and anarchy and unrest for the whole region, but also because the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula can easily find a nest, as some claim it already has, in that part of the world. And the last thing we want is to import that kind of terrorist extremism into the region.
Now, isn't that because of a certain degree of poverty in Yemen and disenfranchisement? Isn't that why people say that Al-Qaeda is sort of fertile in that country?
Al-Qaeda and that kind of extremism, James, is always a result of economic deprivation and poverty as one of the reasons. You're absolutely right. Marginalization, disenfranchisement, economic poverty are reasons why people resort to extremism and to extreme measures. And when I was a young kid at school, in France, my history teacher used to say that communism fishes in murky waters. Now, interestingly enough, we don't have communism anymore, or in a serious way, the way we understood communism two, three decades ago. But we have that kind of radicalism, whether it's religion-inspired or otherwise, which also breeds upon the discontent and the unhappiness of the people. And Al-Qaeda is masterful at manipulating the grievances of people in order to project that destructive extremism that actually is inimical with the three religions, the monotheistic religions, whether Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. So in that sense, you're absolutely right. But in Yemen, Al-Qaeda is also a tool used by politicians, as it is in other countries, where they would use that to their own advantage. In other words, you back me up or else I will get those dastardly terrorists in the country and they will cause you as much headache as they would cause me. So Al-Qaeda has become both a root cause and a symptom of the malaise of the whole region.
Let's move on to Israel and Palestine now. We've talked statehood, we've talked about tensions and the map to peace, the roadmap to peace. Yep. How often have we heard that? Give us an update now on, you know, where we really stand with relations between the two.
The poor Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which has become a poor third cousin, not even a second cousin of all the revolutions and popular revolts that are happening across the whole MENA region, the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales here, as you well know and your listeners would probably know also, are very much involved with what's happening in the Holy Land. And by the Holy Land, I mean geographically for our purposes, Jordan, Israel and Palestine. And we are mandated to stand in solidarity with all the churches of the Holy Land. So in a sense, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is one that is very close to our hearts as much as to our mission as a church. And unfortunately, because of everything else that has happened in the region and because of the lack of success by the Palestinian leadership to actually impose a vision of having their statehood adopted by the United Nations Security Council, it's still being bandied about, but nothing really is coming out of it. And the successes they've had with the UNESCO resolution, where they become full members of the UNESCO, are not compensatory enough to be viewed as political success stories in their own right. What is happening is, unfortunately, that people are tending to forget a little bit the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That is very dangerous. It's very dangerous because you are depriving the aspirations of a whole people for self-determination. And self-determination is a principle under international law that we all agree with, all the way to President Truman of the United States 50, 60 years ago mentioned that. So that is one unfortunate consequence of what is happening. The other is that what is happening is that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is, in my opinion, still the hub of the whole region. You talk to anybody in any of those countries, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Morocco, wherever, and much as they are very much interested by their own problems, and rightly so, the Israeli-Palestinian issue and the rights of Palestinians for self-determination remains very much at the forefront of their political imagination. So when you have somebody like the Foreign Minister of Israel, Lieberman, for instance, coming up today with this crazy notion, and forgive me for using the word crazy politically, but saying that we need to reoccupy all the areas held by the Palestinian Authority because we have to punish the Palestinian Authority for not playing the game as we see it fit. Excuse me, I mean, what do they want the Palestinian leadership to do? To ask Israel to write the draft of how the solution has to come out? It's a very dangerous situation. And much as we hear less of Israel-Palestine these days and more of the rest of the MENA world, let me say that it is a hub and an important hub that we cannot ignore. Hence our work there with charities, with churches, and with the grassroots across the board.
Well, if you want to talk about Christians under the cosh, we certainly should. Coptic Christians in Egypt, of course. Now, before we talk about the elections over there, and I know it's a three-pronged process, as you've told me, it's pretty tough on the Coptic Christians, isn't it? How might they play into the new political future of Egypt?
It's very hard for the Copts in Egypt, James, because during the Mubarak era, they were discriminated against and they were used as a tool for the purposes of the regime itself. When the regime wanted them, they were the favorite sons of Egypt. And when the regime didn't want them, they were completely discriminated against and marginalized. After the revolution started in Egypt in January of this year, we saw those pictures of the cross and the crescent coming together in Tahrir Square, in Midan Tahrir, where they basically came together asking for their dignity and for their citizenship rights for every Egyptian, irrespective of their creed, belief, or background. That has not held together. We spoke, I believe, once about the huge demonstrations in Maspero, about the way the army dealt with that demonstration, the number of Copts who were killed during those demonstrations. And if you ask Copts, they feel second-class citizens, they feel marginalized, and they feel they too are caught up between two entities, the army and the military on the one hand, and the Muslim Brotherhood and rising political Islam on the other. And they consider themselves the original indigenous inhabitants of Egypt, which trace their roots all the way to the pharaohic past of Egypt. And therefore, for them to be caught up in this situation where their rights are not being granted them for worship, for democracy, for representation in political institutions, I think that is something for the 10 or so million Copts in Egypt is a difficult and bitter pill to swallow.
10 million, so it's a big number, and it's a group of people that obviously, not just our viewpoint, but they should be represented and their rights should be preserved and protected. Do you think that will happen in a new political reality that we're about to face?
Well, I don't know, because a lot of analysis has gone on. I think what is happening now with those three rounds of elections We have the first round and then the second round, and the third round would be at the beginning of January. And then the parliament would come together. Now, what is happening is a three-pronged confrontation. You have the army, you have political Islam and Islamist parties like the Muslim Brotherhood, which in my opinion is not the only Muslim party. There are the Salafist parties as well. And then you have the liberal constituencies. Those three are competing for seats in parliament. Now, what is going to happen, James, and this is the trick, I think, this is the gist of it. When the parliament is elected and is convened, they're going to choose a number of deputies or parliamentarians or members of parliament to come together in order to help draft the future constitution of Egypt. Now, if the Copts are marginalized, if they're not elected to parliament, if they do not have a political voice, if they do not come together with others to help draft that new constitution for Egypt, how then would their rights as Coptic Christians be safeguarded in the future? And that is my worry, that we might end up either seeing the rights of the Christians and the Copts in general, whether Orthodox, Catholic or evangelical, being respected and lifted up, or we can see a situation where the previous discriminations that they used to face under the Mubarak regime would be replicated in another format in the new Egypt that we all seem to be talking about.
Well, perhaps this is a question that's better suited for end of Jan, February of 2012.
I think once the results come in, and to be fair, the elections to date have been peaceful, and there has been quite a lot of voting going on. So hopefully that means that more and more people have come out to make their choices. But you're absolutely right. January would be another time to revisit the Egyptian file to see how the new dynamics would affect not only the rights and duties of Coptic Christians, but of all Egyptians across the board.
Harry, I'm still reeling from the formality of calling you Dr. Hagopian earlier. Really not the thing for our type of conversational podcast.
Not after so many podcasts.
Well, exactly.
James.
So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do that bit that makes my feet itch. I'm going to give you the mic and I'm going to give you your chance to have the final word on
this.
Wow, this
is when Harry is let loose to say whatever he wants.
I'm going into hiding, so go for it.
James, I love this bit when you sometimes decide to give me the mic for an afterthought. And if I may, today I'm going to surprise you by going away from the MENA region entirely and sharing with you and your listeners two thoughts that I think are worthy of being mentioned. One, and we are in the period of Advent, you talked about hope, you talked about anticipation, we also talked about reconciliation, but we also know that the story starts with the nativity and ends with the crucifixion and then the resurrection. So there is life and death in this whole biblical narrative of ours. And let me start with the death bit. And I'm sure that many people feel the same sadness I felt when Gary Speed died unexpectedly. Gary Speed being the Wales football manager, who was a brilliant footballer himself and who had become the manager, and he suddenly died at a very, very young age, leaving a young family behind him. I am not a particularly football fan. Yes, I do support a couple of clubs, and I won't go into that now because you're smiling already, but I felt bad for somebody with so much promise who died at such a young age. So I'm sure that a lot of us will have him in our minds these couple of days as his family come to terms with this tragedy. But with that tragedy of death comes also the delight of new life and new hope and renewal. And that is that here in the UK, we have a new Armenian Orthodox bishop who has just been ordained bishop, who has just come back from the Holy See of Echmiadzin in Armenia, which is the equivalent of the Holy See of Rome of Vatican. He was ordained bishop and is the new Armenian bishop of the United Kingdom and Ireland. He's a wonderful man. His name is Bishop Vahan, and he has been here with us already for 2 years as a priest, and now he's been ordained a bishop. And I expect that the relations between the Catholic Church and the Armenian Orthodox Church would be strengthened further, because not only is he rooted in his own Armenian Orthodox faith, but he also has a very good understanding of the Catholic faith. So in that sense, I'm hoping that the intra-Christian relations between him, Bishop Vahan, and our own Archbishop Vincent Nichols and Father Marcus and our Catholic hierarchy here will be strengthened further, not only because of those hierarchs, but because anything that happens at that level should also trickle down on the grassroots and parish levels across the country. So yes, tragic death, but also a nice moment for us all as Christians to celebrate a fellow brother bishop coming into the fold in this country.
Well, Harry, I completely obviously echo the thoughts and prayers for the Speed family at this terrible time. But yes, positivity, and maybe Bishop Vahan will actually come and spend some time in the studio. Can you bend his arm on that one?
I think I can do that. I think one of the things we should start doing is to start introducing new people to our listeners who would give their own perspectives of what is happening across the region and also in this country.
Well, a peaceful and prayerful Advent to you, Harry, and thanks for joining us today.
To you and to your listeners too, and thank you for all your efforts, James.
My pleasure. Don't forget to stick with us. I've said it before, it's our new home, catholicnews.org.uk, where you will find Middle East analysis and all the other news from the Catholic Church in England and Wales.